Avraham says to what he thought were these three Arab travelers, he says, "Yukach na mayim, let us take, I want to give you a little bit of water." The cruelty of Sodom is portrayed in terms of cruelty to guests and strangers. In contrast, Avraham's kindness expressed itself particularly in Hachnasas Orchim. There are many ways to practice types of chesed. Why is Hachnasas Orchim, welcoming guests, the mitzvah of welcoming guests, why is that so emphasized here? Because Hachnasas Orchim is often for the poor. A rich man is in no need of hospitality. He can find an inn or a place to stay. However, Hachnasas Orchim, it differs from tzedakah, or material help to others, in a crucial way. Giving tzedakah demonstrates sympathy. Hachnasas Orchim, however, demonstrates full human equality. The belief that every being has dignity and is just as important as any other. It is much easier to give someone money and send him away than to invite him under your own roof. If I invite him in, that means no matter what his station in life, I am treating him with respect as an equal. Hachnasas Orchim is symbolic of our personal relationships, the understanding that all Jews are B'nai Malachim. They're all Jews are princes, regardless of differences in wealth or knowledge. That is why the Torah gives us this picture, this image of Avraham. The Malachim ask, Aye Sarah Ishtecha, where is Sarah your wife? Vayomer, and Avraham answers, Hineva Ohel, she's in the tent. These travelers were not ordinary people whose eyes see only the surface. These were the angels of God. Their glimpse penetrated and apprehended the image of the true leader, the teacher and the prophetess, to whom everything should be credited. Nonchalantly, they asked, Aye Sarah Ishtecha, where is Sarah, your wife? Without her, you could not play the part that God assigned you, to you. Where is she? Why do people not know the truth? Why has she been trailing behind you? Why does she not match in front of you? After all, the covenant cannot and will not be realized without her. Avraham answered tersely, Hine ba'ohel, she is in the tent. Indeed, she is enveloped in mystery. Sarah, the biblical woman, is modest, is humble, is self-effacing. She enters the stage when she is called upon. She acts her part with love and devotion in a dim corner of the stage, and then leaves softly by a side door, without applause, without the enthusiastic response of an audience, which is hardly aware of her. She returns to her tent, to anonymity and retreat. Only sensitive people know the truth. It is interesting that although Avraham survived Sarah by 38 years, his historical role came to an end with Sarah's passing. Yitzhak leaves the stage together with Rebekah. Yaakov relinquishes his role to Yosef with the untimely death of Rachel. Without Sarah, there would be no Avraham. No Yitzhak, if not for Rivka, and no Yaakov without Rachel. Hashem says, Hamechasa ani me Avraham asher ani oseh. Shall I conceal from Avraham that which I am doing? Three travelers came to announce the birth of Yitzchak, one to destroy Sodom, and the third to heal Avraham. Rashi, quoting the Medrash, explains that each angel is given only one assignment. In fact, there is a connection between the assignments given to the angels. Sodom was prosperous. To quote Iov in Perek Chaf Ches, it had dust of gold. As long as Sodom prospered, Avraham's doctrines, his sermonizing and preaching meant nothing. One cannot preach goodness and kindness if the kingdom of evil is rich and powerful. One cannot gain converts for an idea if its opponents prosper, if they are strong, respected, and feared. An angel came to announce the birth of Yitzchak. In other words, the continuation of Avraham's legacy, his heritage. But Sodom's existence contradicted everything that Avraham taught. Avraham preached equality, kindness, charity, hospitality. Sodom scoffed at these ideas. So when the angel came to tell Avram that Yitzhak would be born and that Avram's hopes would be fulfilled, another angel carried the message that not only would Yitzhak be his successor, but his powerful opponent would be destroyed. This event will strengthen Avram's position, and people will begin to realize that evil does not pay. This is why these two angels had to come together. Despite, you know, the point is that the Rav is making, despite that each has its own unique task, they had to come together. It says the following. Vishamru derech Hashem lasot tzedakah u'mishpat. Okay. That why does God choose Avraham? Because he knows that Avraham will transmit, Lemana Sheitzava will transmit the principles of tzedakah and mishpat and teach his family, his community, Vishamru derech Hashem, to keep the way of the ways of God. In the beginning of the parak, God sent three angels to Avraham during God's own visit to see if Avraham would fulfill the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim instead of remaining to commune with him. After passing this test, God remarks, through his concerns for Kavod Abrios, for human dignity, Avraham had become the model of Tzedakah U'Mishpat. The Torah's emphasis on Kavod Abrios is reflected in the Halacha, which states that one should return greetings even during the reading of the Torah and even during Kriya Shema. Avram was not the first man who discovered the existence of God. The existence of God was known to many of his predecessors, to Shem, to Aver, to Noach. Avram's greatness lay in his discovery of God as the originator and the legislator of the moral law. Emphasis should therefore be placed on the words Derech Hashem and Lasos Tzedakah U'Mishpat Ba'aretz. Avram says, Hine naho alti lidaber el adoshem va'anochi alfer ve'efer. He says, please God, please allow me the ability to speak with you, even though I don't deserve that. All I am is dust and ashes. This phrase has become a foundation of our worldview. The halacha built the laws of modesty on the dichotomy of importance and worthlessness. See, there's a dichotomy between importance and worthlessness. On the one hand, modesty derives from, I am aware that I have just begun to speak to the Lord, the consciousness of man's importance due to his perpetual standing in the presence of the infinite. We must never forget God's constant presence, and this knowledge, this will always give us worth and importance. The infinite God is man's companion. We have the ability to stand, to engage, to encounter God. When Judaism speaks of man's importance, it does not ground this importance only in man's intellect or his spirit, as the Greeks did. The human body is even more important to Judaism. Every organ is holy. Every member of the body has an important function. Every physiological function is important. The body must be clean and holy. We must not defile ourselves by lowering our bodies to the level of an animal. Respect the body, its impulses and functions. If God is willing to walk with a human being, then both body and soul are significant. In this sense, the laws of modesty are the antithesis of I am dust and ashes. The notion that an individual is worthless, okay? On the other hand, modesty is also based on the principle of Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I am dust and ashes. Forgetting this principle can undermine the basis of sanctity and morality. Immorality stems from pride, from those who love themselves and glorify themselves, from those who believe that whatever pleases them and whatever they wish to do is permissible. It has thus come about that the word tsniut, which means modesty and humility, has transformed into a term referring to sexual morality. Modesty and the message of Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I am dust and ashes, are also important in another context. Other nations offer us accounts of the lives of their great figures with many biographical details. For example, Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates, who lived more than 2,400 years ago, are well known to us. We know their works and are fairly well informed about their private lives. However, we have very little biographical information about our great men. Not only those who lived thousands of years ago, but even the great men who lived in the 18th century, such as the Gaon of Vilna, Reb Chaim of Elozhin. The little we do know about them is known to us only by accident. For example, a chance fact in one of their tshuvos that casts some light on their private lives. They appear to us anonymously, like mute figures, without a name or a time frame. Who are the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGadola who saved our people from disappearing? Who were they? Our Chachamim tell us there were 120 members, 120 Chachamim, who established the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. But we know only a few names. We know Ezra, we know Nehemiah, we know Shimon HaTzadik. Who were the members of the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel? Who were the Hasidim HaRishonim, that the Mishnah, that the Gemara talks about? Who were the Sofrim? Who were the Bnei HaNeviim, who say our sages numbered in the thousands? This striking concept expresses the modesty of the great sages. The individual Chacham's importance stems from the fact that his life was devoted to the eternity of the Jewish people as manifested in the Torah Shebaal Peh. What is important is his contribution to this eternity, his statements, his halachot, his analysis, his amendments, his worldviews. His private life is of no interest. The great men of our nation were shy. They did not seek to put their private lives before the public. Anochi Afar Ve'efer. Another thing the Rav said about Anochi Afar Ve'efer. This expression used by Avraham seems to conflict with the concept of Kavod HaBrios, the very idea so well exemplified by Avraham as he fulfilled the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim. In fact, the opposing motifs of man's loneliness, the shiflus ha'adam, and man's greatness, the godless ha'adam, they are both true. Here, in his prayer to God on behalf of Sdom, Avraham uses the expression Anochi Afar Ve'efer, because the approach to God during prayer should reflect man's utter helplessness. Complete self-deprecation is the most important element in the prayer experience. We're going to go forward in the Parsha to when it describes what happened in the aftermath of the destruction of Sdom Amora. Lot's two daughters assumed that there was no one else on earth. Ve'ish ein ba'aretz, that's what they assumed. Lot's daughter had something beautiful to contribute to the emerging personality of the King Messiah, of the Melech HaMashiach. What attribute did this girl possess that Hashem, the Almighty, chose her to be the great-great-grandmother of Ruth, of David, of Shlomo, and ultimately of the Mashiach? Lot's daughter was under the impression, says Rashi in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, we're in Perek Yud Tes Pasuk Lamed Aleph, that a cosmic cataclysm had struck and only three human beings had survived. She acted as she did because she wanted to save humanity. This girl wanted to rebuild the world, to start from scratch and raise another nation to take the place of the human race, which she believed had been destroyed simultaneously with the destruction of Sdom. This was the heroism of an unimaginable caliber. Instead of giving up, she had the courage to try to rebuild the world, to make a new humanity arise from the ashes of Sdom. She convinced her younger sister to do the same. Never mind that their method was primitive and crude. These two girls took upon themselves an impossible task, something staggering and awesome. This plan per se was reprehensible, but their motivation? It was imaginative, it was noble and heroic. The Melech HaMashiach will save the world. Indeed, he will achieve what his great-great-great-grandmothers hoped to accomplish. The heroism of Lot's daughters consisted of their commitment to mankind and their urge to save it. The great vision of a redeemed world would have been impossible had Lot's daughters been destroyed in Sdom. So Avimelech, he says to God, Bisam levavi uvenikayon kapaya sisizos, with the innocence of heart and with clean hands have I done this. The Rav comments, while both Avimelech and Paro abducted Sarah, a cryptic verse in Mishle, quoted by the Medrash in Shmos Rabbah, Chaf, explains the difference between them. A whip for the horse and a bridle for the donkey. According to that Medrash, the horse in this verse is represented by Paro, while the donkey by Avimelech. Paro was openly and consistently evil. After God sent plagues to punish him for attempting to live with Sarah, Paro never feigned innocence. Paro is therefore analogized to a wild horse, a Mustang, which is naturally untamed. In contrast, there are wicked people who don a mantle of righteous hypocrisy to justify their actions. Unlike the wild horse, the donkey often seems placid, yet its bite and its kick are deadly. The Midrash continues with a parable to explain the donkey analogy. A donkey with his owner riding upon him once chanced upon a wayward baby in the marketplace. The donkey jerked towards the baby but did not harm him. People praised the donkey for avoiding the baby. But the rider of the donkey said, "Had I not pulled on the bridle, the donkey indeed would have harmed the baby." Similarly, it was argued that Avimelech, who did not violate Sarah, was virtuous. HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, "He indeed did not try to violate Sarah, because I did not allow it. I pulled him away." In contrast to Paro, Avimelech consistently maintained his innocence. He argued that his hands were clean, his heart was pure. Sarah's coerced abduction was really Avram's fault. Such hypocritical justifications are typical of many evildoers. They act immorally, then blame others for their actions. They engage in Maisa Zimri, but they claim Schar like Pinchas. It's a Gemara in Sota Chav Beis Amud Beis. Two more selections that are very significant. So Hashem says to Avraham, "Call Asher Tomar Eileha Sarah Shema Bekola." When Sarah claims that you have to expel Yishmael because he's a threat on a physical level, on a spiritual level to the development of Yitzchak. So Hashem says, "Call Asher Tomar Eileha Sarah Shema Bekola." Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her voice. Although the Torah and certainly the Medrash provide extensive information about the patriarchs, the matriarch's role is more obscure. In fact, however, Sarah was an equal partner with Avram in the covenant. Rashi here comments that Avram was actually inferior to Sarah with respect to Neviut, with respect to prophecy. When Hashem informed Avram that Sarah was going to bear a son, he said, "Aval, however, Sarah Ishtecha, Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you will name him Yitzchak, the Hakimosi, and I'm going to establish Brisi, my covenant, Ito, with him, as a Bris Olam, as an everlasting covenant." The key emphasis is on the word Aval, however, which follows a reference to the fact that Avram already had a son from another wife. But Aval, however, he is told, that will not be the son to continue the Mesorah, the continuity of the ethical monotheistic community. The covenant continues specifically through Yitzchak. Why? Because Yitzchak emerged from both Avram and Sarah. There can be no covenant, no bris, without Sarah. And the last section from the Akedah, and there's so much the Rav said on the Akedah, is a very, very significant piece. Velo chasachta es bincha es yechidcha mimeni. The Malach Elkim says, "You, Avraham, you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me." The precept, the concept of sacrifice, is a central motif in Yahadus and Judaism. To live in accord with Hashem's word is identical with living a sacrificial life. To act morally is synonymous with a sacrificial action. God summoned man in his sacrificial service. Daber al b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, the very beginning of Sefer Vayikra, and say to them, "Adam ki yakriv mikem korban," if any of you bring an offering to the Lord. What did man bring as an offering to the Lord? What was man called upon to sacrifice? Judaism gave a straightforward answer to this basic theological and ethical question. Man must offer everything he possesses. Nothing is to be spared, and nothing is to be saved for man. The logic of this answer is self-evident. A sacrificial action consists in restoring that which man heretofore considered his own to its rightful owner, and in returning to the master whatever belongs to him, which was entrusted to man's care and of which man erroneously and impudently took possession. Since there is nothing within the reach of man which he does not have in trust for from God, there is nothing whose return to God would not be considered a hallowed sacrificial service. Judaism has insisted upon a total sacrificial gesture on the part of man. When the latter is confronted with his creator, man must return to the master of the universe not only all he possesses in the form of physical goods, but his very self as well, his body, his mind, his spirit, his soul, the whole of his existence in all its boundless manifestation at all levels. Yadus fought relentlessly against the heathen curse of human sacrifice. Thou shalt not do so unto the Lord your God. Call Toeva every abomination to the Lord which he hateth they have done unto their gods. Their sons and their daughters they have burned in the fire to their gods. That's from Parshas Re'eh. Perek Yud Beis in Dvarim, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. So what is one of the classic abomination? Child sacrifice. As an ecclesiastical institution at the level of a temple service, this ruthless cult of child sacrifice was condemned and stamped as murder by Judaism. At an experiential, spiritual level, however, this type of sacrifice is the fundamental one for Judaism. The primitive, brutal cult of perpetuating murder and of extinguishing the physical existence of man as an object in honor of God, that is pagan and abominable. That's a toeva. Yet the offering of the spiritual personality, of the human metaphysical existence to God, is a great heroic act in which Yadus believes man finds his unique charismatic fulfillment. How is this great sacrifice of the self consummated? Yadus gave a terse answer to this question. Man offers himself by engaging in a movement of recoil from himself, by retreating from the position of illusory strength he is prone to take up at certain times, by withdrawing from attitudes of arrogant self-regard and self-centeredness, and from spiritual entrenchment in a false and insolent majestus homine complex. The giving up of the fruits of sweet victory when man is intoxicated by it, and the free acceptance of defeat while triumph is within reach, these are considered the supreme sacrifice which man can bring to God. When excessive giving of charity becomes painful to the giver because the unhallowed self considers giving is nonsensical and keeps on asking himself the annoying question, why should I spend my hard-earned money on others? Then the act of giving becomes a great sacrifice because by doing so, the donor renounces his mastery over his wealth and retreats from his economic position of strength. When the scientist, discovering a new behavioral pattern in nature, instead of gloating in his attainment and becoming vain and haughty, departs from the position of intellectual pride and strength and stands in awe before the Creator, realizing that every scientific advancement deepens the mysterium magnum involved in creation, which remains, in spite of all of our cognitive achievements, it remains numinous and enigmatic. That scientist engages in sacrificial action because he recognizes that absolute knowledge is the exclusive prerogative of God and that the human finite mind is nothing but a reflection of the infinite divine logos. He acknowledges that wisdom is not his, but it is God's. There's much, much more on the Akedah and much, much more on Parshas Vayera. Please feel free to read through the 47 pages that we have in the Masoros HaRav Chumash on Vayera. But this is a small sampling of some great insights that the Rav gave.